Welcome to Geek Speak on KOSP. Wouldn't it be great if every Saturday we always recorded a brand new episode of Geek Speak? Then it'd be fresh and wonderful every week. Unfortunately, that's not always the case. In fact, this week we're doing a little bit of a rerun, but not exactly. So, this is the January 5th episode of Geek Speak podcast. On air, we rebroadcast something from November, which you've already heard. But for the podcast, I figured we'd grab something from our archives you haven't heard. In fact, this June 15th episode, 2013, June 15th, Miles and Bonnie and Ben did a full episode, and we just never got into the podcast. So you probably haven't heard this episode. I hope you enjoy. Keep in mind, you can always learn more about all the episodes on GeekSpeak up at geekspeak.org. If you're looking for the show notes from this episode, just go to the June 15th, 2013. But I assure you, this is the episode for January 5th, 2014. Thanks, and we'll be back next week for a brand new episode of Geek Speak. Keep in mind, we'd love to have you visit us online and give us reviews and all those things. Just go to geekspeak.org and click on links and share us and all that. Geek Speak on KOSP is supported by Mira Software Services. 1,500 software geeks in Western Russia provide iOS and Android for mobile, machine-to-machine, and embedded software engineering. Details at MERA.biz or 650-479-5350. All right. Thanks. See you next week.
It's Saturday, June 15th, 2013, 10:06 a.m. on the Central Coast of California. Today on Geek Speak, we have Bonnie Jean Primsch and Ben Jaffe covering the week in geek news. And we take your calls and comments today. It's time now for Geek Speak. Welcome to Geek Speak, bridging the gaps between geeks and the rest of humanity. I am Miles Elam. Please keep in mind that the views expressed during Geek Speak are not necessarily those of KUSP. With me in the air room are, of course, broadcaster at large and mediator, Miss Bonnie Jean Primsch.
Howdy, howdy.
Ben Jaffe, web instructor and world traveler.
Hello, hello.
And of course, I am Miles Elam, geek, unemployed, slacker once again after so many years.
A slacker, wow.
And Lyle reports that although he is not here with us in the studio, he is listening from the south of France, so we better shape up.
Yes.
Yeah.
Hard life.
Yeah. How are you guys doing today?
Doing very well. Ben, do you want to start off with news?
Yeah, absolutely. I've got some Facebook news. I've got actually two news stories, but they're both brief, so I'm going to kind of combine them together. And they're both about Facebook. So 1 year and 7 months ago, Facebook started construction on a new data center, and it is in the town of Lilia in northern Sweden's east coast.
Sweden? So, why Sweden?
Sweden. Well,
neutral territory?
For one, it's very cold in Sweden. And, of course, one thing we know about data centers, when you put a whole bunch of computers into a room, you get a lot of heat.
Oh,
and you have
true.
To get rid of that heat somehow. And so you can invest in a lot of air conditioning, or you can put your server somewhere in Sweden. And
then just open the window.
Yeah. that's exactly how simple it is.
That's a technology cost savings.
So, and then there are actually a lot of data centers in Lilia, Sweden, also largely because there's a lot of power there. There's a massive amount of hydroelectric in that area. And so they actually have pretty cheap power as well. And you do still need power to actually run the computers and also to cool them, even though it's so cold.
A lot of hydroelectric power, even during wintertime, wouldn't the streams all be iced over?
Well, what you do is you put the ice next to the rooms with the really hot computers, and then it melts and then creates its own energy.
Fair enough. I don't know
if that's what happened. Yeah. That may or may not be.
There's a very large river, and then there are a bunch of hydroelectric dams that draw power from it. And the average temperature is 29.6 Fahrenheit. So, yes, it is very often below freezing, but I think you have to be quite cold for a river to freeze over. It's a little more difficult than a lake freezing over, right? Because of all the movement.
Yes, absolutely.
Yeah. So there's that. But anyway, it's kind of interesting. So one of the things, of course, that they're doing is they're using outside the ambient air temperature outside to cool it. And that seems like a really great idea. But actually, there was some news. It was just released that back in the summer of 2011, Facebook's first data center, and this was in Prineville, Oregon, they actually did a similar kind of thing. They used outside air, and they used this slightly different system for cooling things. And previously, they had hinted at what had happened. They had references to a humidity event within their first data center. What actually happened was there was actually a cloud that formed in their data center for a couple minutes.
Not a cloud, a humidity event.
A humidity event.
I can't just call it a cloud.
That actually rained on their servers.
Oh.
Of course. The irony, of course, is we call servers like that are often some remote town. We call that the cloud.
The cloud. This was quite literal.
I think for the first time there were actually two clouds in a data center simultaneously.
Mm-hmm. I would think, though, that if you were in Sweden, if the temperature were below freezing, that the clouds wouldn't be as much of an issue because the air would be very dry at that point. Once you cool it off, you can't hold the same amount of moisture.
Now you just get snow clouds.
Which is easier to brush off. It's less damage to the system.
Exactly. And, of course, they also say that they have apparently learned from that mistake. And not only are they more careful about their cooling systems, they also put kind of a rubber thing on the power supplies that are in the front of the units, just in case, in case they get splashed by something.
Humidity protection.
Absolutely.
And by the way, FYI, this is why air conditioners always leak all that water out. It's because they have hot air, they cool it off, and you need to sequester that water away or else it will condense where you don't want it to.
Yeah.
That's what's going on there.
That's the puddles.
All right.
So coming up next, Bonnie, do you have a story?
No, it's just us. But no, it's just
it's
me, and
you,
it's
guys.
I
don't know if I've been clear about this, but I'm just the bridge between geeks and the rest of humanity. It's my job to translate you. Also, if you scroll down a little bit, you'll be able to see where we're at.
Yeah. We've got a Google Doc here.
We're trying to use the technology.
I'm looking. So apparently there's a copyright issue.
Well, yeah, okay. So I'll go ahead and cover my next story, which is really both amusing to me and horrifying to me. So talking about copyrights and patents and intellectual property and all of that stuff. Well,
wait a second. Let's back up here. Copyright and patent and trademark, all things that are considered intellectual property, are three things that have nothing to do with one another except for the fact that they are something that can be owned. They have completely different rules. They have completely different. Just so I just have a personal pet peeve against the term intellectual property. It's kind of like saying living things. It's so vague. Yeah. You have no idea what you're talking about anymore.
But one other thing that they have in common is the absolute horrible way humans treat all those things, right? In terms of ownership and in terms of, if you look at the patent system in the United States or generally in the world, it's just really, really broken. And same with, similarly with copyrights and, patents have especially been in the news. But in any case, there is a copyright that Warner Chappell, a company called Warner Chappell Music Inc. owns, and that is to probably the most famous song in the world, which I am not going to sing on air because I might get sued.
Still in dispute.
Yeah, it is still in dispute. It is the Happy Birthday to You song that everybody sings at pretty much every birthday party, at least in the United States, and also quite a bit all around the world.
Except restaurants have been always so careful, and that's why you hear when you go to some random
happy,
restaurant, happy birthday, happy you.
Yeah, or some
whatever.
Crazy variation, yeah.
Yeah, it's tragic. So
we've been kept away from this basic song of our culture for a long time, and it turns out...
Well, it's a brilliant song, or maybe not. I just want to read... So the reason that this is still an issue is mainly that no one has challenged it, right? And so because no one has challenged it, this copyright has hung around and
on the contrary, people have challenged it. It's never gone to a definitive court.
That's what I mean by that. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, just generally, they wind up paying a fine rather than pay for the court fight.
Absolutely. Because, if you put this in a movie or something like that, you can be fined a good amount of money, but it's probably going to cost you more money to go to court and challenge this.
Who are you paying the money to, by the way?
I think you're paying it to Warner Chappell. Okay. They go after you and they say, hey, that's our copyright. Pay up. You know, because you used it without asking us. And I think also the fine of using it without asking is higher than if you were to just ask them. And then if you just ask them, they might just say no. Anyway, so this is I think, absolutely horrible. But there is Good Morning to You Productions has challenged this in court, and it's actually going to court and being properly challenged.
They're fighting the good fight on behalf of everyone.
Mm-hmm. And why Good Morning to You? Why this group?
Do you have one?
I do know why.
Of course, yes.
Hoping that we,
leading question, Miles.
Yes. Very leading question.
It's because there is a song that, according to many sources, predates Happy Birthday to You, which uses the exact same tune, which is Good Morning to You, Good Morning. Yeah.
Yeah, that's right. That's right.
And in fact, there are many songs of that era that with slightly varied lyrics that didn't have to do with birthdays.
It's like an open source tune.
Yeah, it was just a melody that has been around for quite a long period of time.
Yeah, yeah. And it makes sense musically why a melody like that would be around for so long. It's somewhat formulaic, actually. So, but anyway, I just want to read the introduction of the class action complaint just to put out these facts. It says, this isn't, quote, this is an action to declare invalid the copyright that defendant Warner Chappell claims to own to the world's most popular song, Happy Birthday to You, to declare that Happy Birthday to You is dedicated to public use and in public domain, and to return millions of dollars of unlawful licensing fees collected by defendant Warner Chappell pursuant to the wrongful assertion of copyright ownership of the song. So over all of these years, Warner Chappell has been collecting these licensing fees, and this is not only trying to declare the copyright invalid, but also to try and return some or all of the improperly collected licensing fees. So that makes me happy, because copywriting a song like that, which has been around, I'll put the news story online. It has a lot more details about what they claim is the latest year that it possibly would have been under copyright based off of our records of when it was around.
There's details online.
And online at geekspeak.org. Mm-hmm.
Right.
Exactly. So you'll find that up on geekspeak.org. And
as soon as we find the time to update the website, which will happen sometime soon after the show ends.
Yeah. So somewhere around
early afternoon.
So we'll say noon.
Gentlemen, do we know when this case will be decided, what the timeline is for knowing fate of this little song will be?
I don't.
When was the last time you ever heard of a court case being decided on a schedule?
That's a point. All right. I rescind my question.
There's also a documentary film, which is being made, tentatively titled Happy Birthday, and it's going to be about the song. So when that comes out, probably before the court case is resolved, you'll be able to watch that and learn even more.
So hopefully the court case will be resolved by the time your birthday rolls around again, Ben. Then it will be a happy one.
No, I don't need that song. I really don't need that song to have a happy birthday.
I prefer the shorter one.
And we will be hearing some more news updates from Ben with wonderful commentary from Bonnie Jean Primch and a discussion about various technical things such as encrypted email within the cloud. But first, we have this special break.
and on the next 7th Avenue project, the Stooges Music Group. It's one of the hottest young brass bands to come out of New Orleans in years, mixing everything from traditional Dixieland to jazz, funk, and hip-hop in one highly intoxicating blend. Three of the Stooges share their music and the secrets of their success with KUSP's Robert Pauly, and that's tomorrow at noon on 88.9 KUSP or at KUSP.org.
That sounds like a really good show.
Stooges
and Robert Pauly.
Yeah, what could go wrong?
And if you want to join the conversation here on Geek Speak in the second half of the show, you can call up at area code 831-476-2800, or you can call toll free at 1-800-655-5877. So I promised a news story here, Ben. What can you give us about, say, Google?
All right, let's talk about Google. I'm just going to talk in general about navigation and driving as well, because I actually have a couple news stories that link together quite well. It's a good week for that, for linking news stories together.
Well, in general, we like talking about Google's navigation because it tends to be good as opposed to cough apples.
cough.
Yeah, it navigated me into a lake. No. Have you guys ever used Waze before?
Yes, I use it on a regular basis.
I had never heard of it before I heard the news bit you were about to relate, sir.
Ooh, okay. So Waze is kind of similar to Google Navigation in that you can say, hey, I want to go to KUSP because it's 9 a.m. and I'm supposed to be on the radio in an hour, you know? Mm-hmm. So you tell Waze KUSP and it takes you there, right? Just like Google Navigation. But a couple differences. First of all, it will give you it'll give you information about things you might be interested in as you're on your way, so it understands your route. Whereas if you try and do that with Google's navigation, it'll say, oh, you're currently here. Well, here in this big radius, here is all the stuff that's near you right now. But in reality, I don't care what's near me right now. I care what's along my route, right? Mm-hmm. So that's one of the things that Waze is better at. And then I think the most important thing is Waze. Waze is, by the way, an Israeli startup, and they've been going for years, and they have a fantastic user base. And that user base updates the maps, creates parts of the maps that have changed, you know, and then also
it's navigation as a social app.
Yeah, exactly.
And it's a little bit like KUSP's Commute Club, but more involved.
Yeah, much more involved. Yeah. You can also say, hey, where's the cheapest gas near me? And people, as they're, you know, as they go and get gas, they'll update Waze with the prices.
Oh,
of their
I didn't know
station.
That. The only times I've used Waze are things like, as opposed to on Google Maps and other map software, where it will show you, oh, this is a slow part of the commute or the like. It will actually tell you on Waze, in this section, people who are other Waze users, that's how it works. And you have a phone that has GPS and can tell how quickly they're moving.
Yeah.
And it allows me to calibrate my speedometer as well, is that it will tell you, oh, and up ahead of you, the traffic is going an average of 22 miles an hour.
Yeah. And it does that because it's crowdsourced. It takes all of the Waze users and it looks at where they all are, where they're going, where they're driving, and then roughly how fast they're going. And it can infer traffic conditions based off of that.
And so how are users updating that information? Are they texting
have the app open. Uh-huh. And it will tally how fast each of those vehicles is going and then get the information together.
And is the same thing true for, the gas price is totally cheap right here?
Well, the gas price thing is new for me, but and that one, I'm assuming you're at the gas station. But
You don't want to do that when you're driving.
But the app does have a thing where you don't have to take your eyes off of the road or anything like that. You put your hand over the device and the proximity sensor will notice that you are covering it. And then it'll prompt you through a voice prompt you with a little dee-deet, and then you can say what the condition is. You can say, like, there's an obstruction in the road, uh-huh, or there's a car on the side, and it will take that information and say, you're reporting car on the side of the road. Is this correct? And you can say yes or no to confirm, and then that reports it. So you never even have to take your eyes off the road. As long as you know where your phone is, you just move your hand over there.
And it sounds like there have been recent reports that the sort of voice-activated systems can be as distracting as texting and driving. But if it's like a is that right, yes or no confirmation thing, that means you're less involved with the voice activation thing and aren't being as distracted from the road, potentially.
Yeah, presumably. Mm-hmm. What's interesting about this is, well, one thing that's interesting about covering this story is that all of us, every single one of us, is learning new things about Waze. I didn't know that it had that feature, right? But the story
and
here...
I hear it's being bought by someone.
Yeah, thank you.
There we go. And now to the point of
the
story.
I'm inhaling to say this and you're like, throw it out there. So yeah, Google has decided to buy Waze. So that's where Google comes in.
They've just decided to do it. Therefore, it's happening.
Google is buying Waze for somewhere around $1.3 billion. That's a lot of money.
Unless you're Google.
Unless you're Google. Then it's like...
Here you go, kid.
All right, here you go. Here's a 20. So anyway, that's... I mean, it depends on kind of where you stand on the Google issue. If you feel like Google is evil, then of course you're going to be like, oh, they're buying another awesome product and it's going to go away. But if you are more positive about Google, then you might say, well, this is really cool because it's going to improve what is currently already the best product out there, right? So in terms of navigation and all of that stuff. So it's a pretty interesting issue. In related news, there is some new... there is yet another study that says, hey, users can't text while driving. It's really dangerous.
It's bad.
Even when it's hands-free.
Yeah.
And this is a study that was done by AAA, the insurance company. And what it says is texting a friend verbally while you're behind the wheel causes a, quote, large amount of mental distraction compared with when you're holding a phone conversation or if you're talking with a passenger, that's moderate to significant. And if you're listening to music, that's a small amount of distraction.
Okay, so that's something that raises a question for me, which is this the same category as you're reporting on the road case? Because if you're texting,
that's what I wanted to
yeah,
know.
if you're texting someone, presumably it's a topic other than the current road conditions.
Well, I'll tell you my experience, which is, again, this is anecdotal, right? But my experience was when all of this new text-to-speech stuff, you know, just wave your hand in front of your phone and it'll ask you what you want, that kind of stuff. When all that started coming out, I started using it while I was driving, and I found that I was sometimes even more distracted doing that than I ever was interacting with my phone, because, you know, sometimes the text to speech isn't the speech to text isn't perfect. Sometimes you say, you know, report road condition, you know, some road incident, and it'll say you're reporting, and it'll say something completely different, and then you have to say wait, you know, go back or cancel or whatever. So that you're interacting with it in a more frustrated way, and you're giving it more of your attention, which could be more unsafe.
Right, and that's something about Waze is you really should learn the verbiage it's expecting to hear. Because if you say something slightly different in a colloquial fashion,
well,
you know, like the fuzz is coming up, you know, like that doesn't quite work.
Watch out for the fuzz. that does give me a little caution about, you know, how this will be incorporated, how Waze will be incorporated. If it becomes like an even more awesome thing that more people know about and use, does that equal to more distracted driving?
Yeah. Well, one thing that I do want to point out, though, I didn't know about the whole waving your hand in front of it and then talking to it feature. But if you're interacting with it, if you click like update gas prices or report incident, it'll actually pop up and say, hey, you know, if you're driving, don't do this. If you're a passenger, press okay. You know, so it says, if you're a driver, don't interact with Waze right now.
Well, everything,
because you're driving.
Everything in life is an opportunity cost. So I wonder, the decreased attention that the person who's reporting it gives, does that get offset by the dozens of people who will know that there is an obstruction in the road coming up within a mile?
If I die in service of dozens of other drivers,
well,
then that's okay.
No, it's more of along the lines of...
If I cause an accident, but to benefit others...
With a lot of other people having to deal with this item in a short period of time, having one person slightly distracted more...
No, I like the passenger idea better. Moot,
but it's
passenger.
Not, it's not slightly distracted more. It is, I mean, it's a large amount of mental distraction.
Yeah,
I mean, now
large.
I'm inferring from this other study what it would be, but I feel like it would be a large amount of distraction to interact with...
No, I'm not arguing that point. I'm just talking in terms of what is the trade-off for the advance notice to a lot of other people after the fact. Like, if I'm sure no one's done any studies on this yet because it's such new technology, such a new field, but wondering what that would end up being on the aggregate of some people are more distracted, but a whole lot of other people are better prepared.
Yeah.
But what point is that if one person winds up causing an accident? That's one too many people causing an accident.
But that's the thing, though, is you have one person who is in greater danger of causing an accident, but you have a lot of other people who may be distracted by the radio or distracted by looking in another direction. They don't notice that there's a mattress in the second lane, which actually happened to me this past weekend.
That's
when I was going to going off to Sonora, driving along Highway 680 or 580, something like that.
And you wished someone had reported the mattress.
No, on the contrary, someone did. Oh. Like the Waze app actually announced to me obstruction in the road. Mm. And I suddenly became a lot more alert and was like looking and saying, like, which lane should I be in? I'm like watching and looking up ahead and going, oh, there's something in the road. I need to move over fairly quickly. It was an actual help to me. Like, I would not have been, I would not have wanted to be the person that runs into that mattress.
So you were grateful for that distracted person who reported it.
Yes, well, absolutely.
I do want to say, though, I feel like we're only arguing a part of the issue, because you're not just reporting traffic jams or accidents or hazards. You can also report a policeman is on the side of the road, you know, with a little radar gun. Mm-hmm. Or there's a traffic light camera. Or you can actually do map chat, where you can leave chats for people mm-hmm. on the map, and or map issues or closures or gas prices. And those are all things that don't make you any safer, really. I mean, maybe they'll make you not get a traffic a speeding ticket or something like that, but at the same time, they come at the expense of drivers being distracted. However, the thing that I like about this technology is that Waze will still work even if nobody reports anything. It'll know that there's a significant slowdown in this mm-hmm. area because it sees several people having that significant slowdown. Or the passenger that you're riding with will be the one updating the map or something. So if you take away the driver's reporting on Waze aspect, you still have some people reporting, and you still have the crowdsourcing aggregate thing that happens automatically. So
benefit.
Yeah, you still have a tremendous benefit from using an app like this. I think it's really important to not give drivers any ability or as much of an ability to distract themselves.
Yeah, to not increase their chances of being
distracted. Yeah, because if we know anything about human nature, it's that we're overconfident and we're easily distracted, right?
I know my passenger's supposed to do this, but I don't have one, so I'm going to go ahead and do
and
it
also,
myself.
And also, devil's advocate,
like,
though,
80% of drivers think they're better than the average. You know what I mean?
Right. But devil's advocate, where is the cutoff? Do we say no loud music? Do we put controls on the radio so they cannot go particularly loud? Do we say you can only listen to music, you can't listen to talk radio shows like Geek Speak because it's a conversation and it would be far more distracting than just the melody.
Far more distracting than the average
right.
radio.
And so it's...
Well, okay. So, but the difference between my argument and your argument is I'm saying don't put the features in place in a way that they're easily accessible to drivers. You're saying don't curtail users, don't forbid things, right? Don't say you're not allowed to do this, you're not allowed to
do
that.
No, what I'm saying is that the radio is a distraction.
Oh,
do we consider that something that we should be curtailing as well? Because this is the line of argument of saying we should be avoiding anything that can distract while you're driving.
Gentlemen, it seems like the way to go would be to, as we create new technologies, to make them driving friendly.
Yeah. And for that matter, do we ban drivers who have small children in the car?
Because
anyone who has children can know they absolutely are a distraction, probably more so than texting. Now, I'm going to...
You know what it boils down to is nobody drive without a passenger.
Right. I'm going to bring up a little bit of the paranoiac side of our argument here.
How long are we going to work on this story? Right. I just want to know that.
There is one other related story, but first I want to hear what you say about paranoia.
Which is with regard to Prism, which has been in the news.
Ah, yeah.
Ah, here we go.
And
so what's Prism, for those of us who don't know?
Prism was the program, one part of Verizon, the U.S. government going after Verizon, saying, give us all the metadata about a phone call, you know, when a call began, when the call ended, who you were calling, where you were when you were calling.
So that metadata, and then spread out, as it turns out, to other companies like Amazon and Google and
Facebook. That's a bit more complicated with the issue, because that was saying they had direct access to their main servers. That doesn't appear to be the case anymore.
But that was part of Prism, right?
But it doesn't appear to be the case, actually.
It mainly
is that they are accessing their servers from the outside, like we would. In other words, through the web protocol. And you are accessing their servers, a web server.
Oh, I thought there was something about FISA requests.
Yes, that's okay. This is going a far afield. Let's talk about this a little bit later.
All right. The point you wanted to
the
make.
The point I wanted to make was that about this technology, about Waze, one of the things about it is that it is dependent upon the fact that you have a GPS on your personal device, meaning that it is keeping track of where you are at all times.
By the way, everyone, we know where you are.
Right. And it's not going to the government per se, but it is going to a private company that is storing this data and making metrics about it and seeing what they can do in terms of monetization. That's just the nature of the corporate beast. And so when you break into that whole aspect of a FISA request, as you were bringing up, Bonnie, where they can say, hey, we want to have this information about this particular user, that information becomes available and it becomes something that you have to worry about. If this is this thing that is extremely, in my opinion, convenient and helpful to my day-to-day life, but also takes away from my ability to interact with my world in an anonymous fashion.
Yeah.
In a fashion that I am accustomed to growing up without this device. Like, I spent a fairly large amount of time driving without having a GPS device in my system, in my presence.
Yeah. So now that sort of muddies the water of if it's net benefit or not. Like, I get to get where I'm going easier, but government has a chance of knowing exactly where I am at any given
time. Well, something I'd like to bring up, which is that difference between a social problem and a technical problem. The technical, we know about. We know there's a GPS device in our phone that is tied to us by a credit card and in our ID. And do we follow through with saying, okay, so we know that this is technically possible and in some ways through PRISM technically likely. Do we institute a social program, in other words, laws, to curtail the ability to do this? Or do we have, for example, the secret courts that are involved with FISA to say, no, this is going to be a completely opaque system to us?
Well, I vote for transparency.
Right. But I mean, that's but it's a social problem rather than a technical one. We already know what the technical issues are, and technically you can't solve that problem. It's inherent to if you want to
you
be
have
able
to
have the functionality, the technology has to be there. If you don't, then that's fine, but you are depriving yourself of the ability to take advantage of the advantages that the technology brings to us.
So technology can't totally take care of us all by itself. It takes thinking people.
Yes. Mm. Thank you, Bonnie. That was very succinct.
I am the Geek Speak synthesizer.
Now, I want to bring this topic back to driving and then close it out. A little bit more paranoia in a different way.
We always need more paranoia on this show.
Yes.
Oh,
I come
boy.
Here for my dose. That's why I'm here.
So federal regulators, I'll put the story up for more details because I just want to, we probably want to move on. But some federal regulators are calling for some kind of a technological solution to prevent drivers from interacting with their cell phones. Disable notifications popping up, disable your ability to interact with your cell phone and start new actions and things like that, especially with data saying that every input in a phone takes approximately 2 seconds and a total of 12 seconds to complete a task. That's a lot of distraction when you're driving, especially at 80 miles an hour.
Yeah.
So that's number one. And then in addition, recently introduced to the New Jersey State Senate, which could actually become a law, is a bill that would let New Jersey cops search phones after car crashes. And the reasoning behind that is, you can search the phone, see if anyone was texting, see if anyone was on a phone call, figure out whether the phone had something to do with the crash. But at the same time, I mean, talk about a slippery slope, you know,
holding that for liability.
Absolutely.
For information gathering, I think for data collection, that would be acceptable to me to know what the danger is, because that's just the only way to know for sure is to collect data. To use that as a liability, it may not have been a contributing factor, but then going, look, see, that person received a text, therefore...
They have a communist book, therefore they're a communist.
And you receive a text doesn't mean you read a text, too. I mean,
yeah.
And if you have something to add to this conversation, please give us a call at 476-2800 or toll free at 1-800-655-5877, although it doesn't necessarily have to do with this. If you have something to talk about that isn't paranoid related, then please call in. We will more than welcome that conversation.
Repeating that phone number, 1-800-655-5877.
Or locally at area code 831-476-2800. So, Ben, do you have a geek bit for us?
I have three fast geek bits. First of all, actually, I just want to mention, you were talking about sharing metadata, and there's actually a pretty good article about the slippery slope of sharing metadata. So just sharing very, very, very basic information about phone calls, maybe the length of phone calls or where you were at this point in time or whatever, you can actually get a lot of information from that, and even though it seems very innocuous. So I'm going to post a link up at geekspeak.org. Give that a read, because sharing metadata, even if you don't have content of messages, is pretty bad. Two other quick geek bits, things you want to see. Google Glass, some people got a piece of hardware, the Google Glass piece of hardware, and actually broke it apart and took a look and they took a look at what was inside, and it's really kind of cool to see such a small device and what's inside of that, and what creates that experience.
Yeah, I actually like the fact that there is a new term for people who are wearing Google Glasses.
Oh, yeah. I heard about that.
Go on.
Glass hole.
And of course,
we'll see how that goes.
There are only, 6,000 or 10,000 of them out there, and already someone's
already
come up with that term.
Yeah.
Lastly, there is a flying bicycle. However, this flying bicycle, it's not like E.T. It's like there are humongous fans on the side of this bicycle, and it's not powered by a human. It's got this tremendous battery on it. Which is kind of a bummer. Like, when I first read the headline, I was thinking, ooh, flying bicycle, you pedal really hard and you take off, but no, nope. Not the case.
Okay, well, let's take a call.
They're stacking up.
Yeah. Let's take a call from Elizabeth and Aptos talking about our discussion. Hello, Elizabeth.
Hi there.
Oh, hi. I missed part of that. I just had a quick thought. One of my pet peeves, since you brought up the subject, I thought I'd just throw in that I've noticed when people are listening to the radio or even talking in a car together, there's a different type of concentration and distraction than if I'm talking on the phone in the car and, say, I'm going to be late and I'm trying to figure out where to meet someone, and there's a certain, I think if someone watched your eyes, they would almost go into your head a little bit, like they turn up, like you have to think, or... You know, if you were talking to someone on the phone and arguing or trying to figure out a problem, there's just a whole different level to me of engagement than even if I'm listening to the most brilliant geek speak show where I have to really concentrate. It's a very, very different type of distraction, and so I have a real thing against talking on the phone while driving, but that's just my feeling, is that the interaction and that engagement is... It like kind of puts you in your head instead of in your body where you need to be when you're driving.
Okay, so I have one question for you, and that is how much of that do you think, in your personal opinion, is due to the fact that ever since the first day that we started driving, we turned on the radio to listen to music or to listen to NPR, for example. Well, it usually hits us, most
sadly,
of us when we're getting older.
I can only hear like a third of the words you're saying.
Oh, I'm sorry.
With the connection. I would love to answer the question, but I couldn't hear it.
Well, how much is due to the fact that we are used to listening to the radio or to NPR in the car and have been doing so since we were 16 or 17 years old, as opposed to... this new thing, which is cell phones in the car, which has only happened in the last 10 years or so?
I don't think it's that. I think it's a different kind of interaction. And like I said, if someone were to study this, I think you'd find when you're actually talking to someone, like I'm talking to you on the phone right now, my eyes are going a little bit, it's different than when I'm listening to the radio. It's like your eyes do, or your where you go in your brain. Yeah. It's like a different concentration, sort of.
Yeah, absolutely.
Does that make sense to you?
Yeah.
And also, data has shown that if you're talking to someone on the phone versus talking to someone in the passenger seat, that's also a different kind of interaction. And one of the theories behind that is perhaps that the person in the passenger seat can see when you're trying to make a difficult lane change to get onto onto the interstate or something.
That's
and so they
point.
Stop talking or you know, they give you a little bit more space, brain
right.
space, I guess.
That makes a lot of sense.
Whereas if you're on the phone, you
right.
know, they have no idea where you are or what you're doing.
That makes a whole lot of sense. Yeah, I think it's a disembodiment issue because I think when you're driving, you need to be embodied. I think music can be embodying. I think even listening, you know, to a talk show, listening to a book on tape, whatever podcast, it's not totally embodied, but it's like it puts you present. It's more present
right.
in a certain way.
Well, thank you for your call.
You're welcome.
All right, take care.
Thanks.
Bye. And let's try another Elizabeth, this one from Monterey. Hello, Elizabeth.
Hi there. Okay, I have a quick question about FaceTime. I have a Mac.
FaceTime, the Mac technology for doing video calls?
The face thing. Right. I have a Mac laptop, which I don't use any face-to-face communications, and I was busy doing some research a couple days ago, and suddenly I was looking at my own face in real time on my computer screen. I was like a mirror. I was looking at myself working at my computer, and then I noticed the little green dot at the top that says the camera's on. And somehow, I mean, who can come in and turn my camera on? And, you know, it was really creepy, and then pretty soon some text came on the screen that was trying to pitch me to sign up for FaceTime.
Mm. So
but
what?
I think that's really creepy. Who
it is.
What
that?
Probably, well, certainly I'm sure seemed creepy. What probably happened is the FaceTime application, which comes shipped with your Mac, got launched somehow. And maybe
not
you actually.
A new Mac. I've had it about 4 years.
But it comes when you upgrade your operating system.
It. No, I know what you're saying.
Yeah, so what happens is when you launch FaceTime for the first time. Miles,
I'm shaking my head, Adam, because this is someone has hacked into your computer and has turned on your camera and is interacting with you.
That's
no
not
way.
Some kind of a FaceTime hack?
But no.
Yes,
no.
They can talk to the FaceTime app and invoke it, but I'm assuming here that you did not start the FaceTime app.
I did not, no.
Yeah.
And the pitch was for me to sign up.
Okay, so the whole idea of the pitch being to have you sign up and the fact that you were seeing your own face on your screen, I'm going to stick to my original hypothesis that what happened was somehow FaceTime got launched, whether that was you accidentally clicked on it from the app launcher or somehow it got searched in Spotlight or you accidentally double-clicked from the applications bar or some other way. I mean, there are a number of ways you can accidentally launch an app. It also may have been on your dock.
Then the second thing is I've used Google for my search for years and years and years, and yesterday when I went into Safari, Yahoo showed up. So I went online, and there were a lot of people complaining, where did Google go, and now I've got Yahoo. Well, I went into Safari and switched it back to Google, but does that mean there's someone out there fiddling around with my computer?
That may be an ISP thing. I don't know. Some ISPs have tended to...
But it was easy enough to change back, but it just seems to me it's eerie, just... Sort of.
Well, yeah.
Let me just wrap up. I wanted to clear
something up though with you first, which was you were saying that it was pitching you to join FaceTime, but it was text coming on there. Was the text just all appearing, or were you seeing it being typed out?
No, the text appeared about 5 or 6 seconds after my image because it took me a few seconds to figure out what is going on here.
Okay. Ben's right. I'm wrong.
Yeah. So let me again just explain this in one go. So it's all at once. FaceTime gets launched accidentally. It's never been launched before. You don't have an account with FaceTime, but the application is on your computer.
Okay.
The way FaceTime works is when you first launch up FaceTime, it'll show you your own face, and then you can make phone calls.
Oh, wait. I get it. So somehow I had been doing something exotic and clicked into it.
I mean, it could have been you or it could have been something like an errand click or something like that.
Oh, okay.
And then
it.
The whole pitching it to get you to sign up, that's simply FaceTime asking you to log in with your account. FaceTime,
right.
The application.
And then this whole thing about switching from Google to Yahoo just instantly.
I don't think they were related at all, first of all.
Yeah, they're not related,
but
they're both instances.
The other weird thing this week.
But you were saying other people were complaining about that. That's what makes me think that the ISP was the one who switched this out. I've seen this with some ISPs.
Thank you. I mean, that was paranoid, but, you know, that's what we're doing this morning.
It's not paranoid if they're really out to get you.
Thank you.
All right, take care. Thank you for the call. And Rich from SoCal.
Hi, I'm next entrant in the How Paranoid Am I contest.
All right. Let's find out.
Okay, so for 5 years, I've been running a website for a local community organization, and I've sent emails in the community. Well, CapitolaCVRA@gmail.com is the email we've used, and I've used Pandora and Shrink the Web and all kinds of things that are signed up to it. And in the last 6 months, one by one, they're getting stopped, canceled, and they're saying, we don't think that Capitola CVRA is a person. So you have to specify a person, you know, who's behind it all. And gradually it's disappearing from being the organization to being me. And I want to know, why is that happening? Why are people demanding that you can't name something for a non-person?
Well, that's going to be dependent upon the organization. Any corporation can make whatever rules they feel.
You don't think it's the NSA coming in and saying, okay, well, we can't trap this. We can't track this if we don't know who it is?
No, I don't. That name, because it's...
Shrink the Web is doing it. I mean, it's just like they're knocking it off one piece by one piece here.
Now, that one I don't believe is a central nefarious, you know, black helicopter organization doing it. That's more along the lines of because honestly, you can put whatever name you want in there.
I can't put Capitola CVRA.
Right, but I mean, like, the idea is that they can look to see, is it look like a person's name or does it look like a business name? But you could put in something like, my name is Roy G. Biv, and they would probably accept that.
You think so, or you think they really want to find out, they need to find something that indicates that you have some active life outside of that name?
I don't know, but it would be dependent upon the individual business. I don't think that there's an overarching, big brother effect going on right there.
Okay.
That's my opinion anyway.
All right. Thanks.
All right. Take care.
Thanks for calling.
And hey, let's hit Alex, our Southern California correspondent.
Is this
Hello, Alex?
Oh.
Oh, nope. Alex is on line 6, apparently, because line 4 is Jason. Hello, Jason.
Oh.
Hey, hello. Sorry about that.
So I wanted to get back to the driving and Google topic a little bit.
Okay.
One of the things that seems to come up is distracted driving. And I noticed that you haven't talked about the Google self-driving car initiative. And maybe a little bit of speculation on how the Waze purchase might augur for the future of the self-driving car.
Oh, that just makes all kinds of sense, right?
Yeah,
because if we're talking self-driving cars, then Waze and car can talk to Waze and car, and the user's not involved, and there's no distraction because they're not in charge of the driving.
I don't know. I guess I'm a little... I don't see the connection as much because Waze seems very much people helping people. The Google self-driving car has... like sub-millisecond reaction times. So it doesn't need to know that there is a
instruction.
No,
I think I disagree.
Yeah, Waze can still...
I mean, think about it.
You mean for alternate routes.
It's two things. Waze is two things, right? It's people helping people by reporting things. And then it's also the phones and devices automatically figuring out where traffic is, rerouting, doing all of that stuff. That, I think, is the technology that Google's really interested in, because they can add reporting functionality probably fairly simply. But to build like an infrastructure of crowdsourced devices with or without people interacting, that's kind of cool. So it makes sense, I think. Yeah, the Google self-driving cars will be able to do the reporting back.
All right. Was that your comment?
And also, just to bring in one other piece of technology in that happened this week at Apple's Worldwide Developer Conference, on the keynote, they actually did a demo of an iOS device driving, cars around the track. So again, we're moving more and more toward this. And the sooner I can just spend my time in the commute talking to my friends, the better off I'm.
And the more people, and if people want to learn more about that, you can look at the Apple Worldwide Developer Conference to see that demo. It's really quite cool to look at. Thank you for your call.
Thank you.
All right, take
care. Thanks, Jason.
And now I'll bring Alex, the Southern California correspondent, online. Hello, Alex.
Good morning, everybody.
How's it going?
Going all right. I had a quick, a little extra comment. You're talking about the different surveillance that's going on and being able to track for GPS within phones and, you know, whether or not the government should be able to do that and all of that.
Should we be creeped out or not?
What was that?
And should we be creeped out or not?
Right.
You're talking to a security analyst. Alex Slias, being a security analyst who works in Southern California. Yeah, I'm sure his bias is going to be for it. This is creepy.
Well, yeah, I certainly find that to be creepy. But at the same time, what is I almost think is worse is it's not just the government being able to go in and get it. How many apps do you have installed that are allowed to access your location information? How many apps do people actually go and install that? And not all of them. You just authorize them to use that information. And there are markets out there where you can go and buy information about people's locations, and you can buy the information about cell phone locations. And I'm not saying all apps do that. Certainly not. There's a minority that do. But there is a market, and that's not even illegal.
Thank you for removing any amount of sleep I was going to get for the next week. Yeah, that's great.
Just to add to that paranoia, I thought I'd put it over the top there.
Yeah,
yes,
I think we just need to end the show now. I can't take any more of this.
La, 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 la.
Well, no, let's try to take one more call. Thank you for your call, Alex.
Sure, all thank
right.
you.
All right, bye. And let's see if we can fit in Timothy. We have about 1 minute.
Okay, well, you guys were talking about Wolfram Alpha a few episodes back, and you thought there must be a joke there. And I thought Wolfram Alpha was a pack leader with an identity crisis.
A pack leader with an identity crisis. I'm sorry, I don't get it.
Wolf Alpha?
Wolfram Alpha.
And for the non-geeks, I need a little background before I can even parse that.
Wolfram Alpha is a search engine, but it doesn't work off of, for example, the way Google does, which is saying who talks to one another. It actually has some intelligence to try to deduce the type of thing you're asking for and give you relevant information on that basis. I guess it's harder to. It's not a direct corollary with Google.
Yeah, you can ask it how many fish are in the sea, and it'll understand what you're asking and say total estimation of fish biomass, and then
Thank
calculate
you.
It from there.
Okay.
That's an example.
Yeah.
So,
and so Wolfram Alpha is a pack leader with an identity crisis.
Yeah, it's an alpha.
Yeah, that had the words
okay.
for me.
All right.
Might need a little punch up.
So. GeekSpeak is a registered service mark of David Lawrence and is used with permission. Thanks to Rick Feldman for managing the phones. Thanks for listening. This is Central Coast Public Radio, KUSP Santa Cruz. We're streaming and podcasting at KUSP.org. To find out more about this or any episode of GeekSpeak, please visit KUSP.org. Thank you so much, Bonnie Jean Primsch and Ben Jaffe. Coming up next is Car Talk.